Normally we do these things on Rumble. This is our first Twitter space together, but we have over half a million between us. So I thought I'd try it this way. All right, Scott's a speaker now. Go ahead, Mr. Ritter. See if you can see if it works.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
Got it. Came in loud and clear. Excellent. Yep, we're ready to go. Oh, so much has happened. We got a new NATO weapon from Russia and Ukraine. We had Biden giving a pardon to his son. No shock there. And we've got, as Jake Sullivan said, Al-Qaeda's on our side, leaking over the border of Turkey and attacking Syria. I thought we'd start there and get your thoughts on this mess. Do you think the timing was a little suspicious or coincidental that right after a ceasefire with Hezbollah in Israel that ISIS or, you know, Al-Qaeda in Iraq is now in Syria and restarting the Syrian war? We had him a second ago.
Yeah, are you there? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, now we're
As I was saying, I don't think it's a, I think it's not a coincidence. What we have here, again, according to some sources, is a plan that was devised to take place in March, being rushed forward to take advantage of the emerging new geopolitical reality that was brought about by the Israeli Hezbollah ceasefire. The feeling was that they could exploit what appeared to them to be chaos and uncertainty in the ranks of the nations that would be in a position to support Syria, Russia, bogged down in Ukraine, Hezbollah tied up in a conflict with Israel, now locked into a ceasefire, Iran making a strategic decision not to do anything that would be seen as provocative by the United States in the lead up to Trump coming in, hoping that there might be a new approach, and then the Syrian government, you know, demobilizing. Basically, Syria took the Astana agreements of a couple of years ago to heart and demobilized, and was, you know, serious about implementing, you know, a peaceful solution to this problem. And now we know that Turkey had no intention of ever following through on this. Turkey apparently is one of the masterminds behind this offensive, and it's designed to create a reality of a de facto Turkish province in Aleppo, to recreate the Ottoman reality that Turkey feels was denied them at the end of the First World War. So I don't think there's any coincidence at all. This was a deliberately planned action. The timing was advanced, but it's something that, we're seeing strategic thought put into this.
We also saw another pager attack. Where have we seen that before? Which is a war crime. You cannot just put explosives in the supply chain for consumer goods and attack people. And as in Lebanon, that disproportionately hits doctors and nurses who use pagers. I think everyone can guess, well, we know what happened in Lebanon. The Israelis did it, but this happened in tandem with Al-Qaeda, almost like they worked together or something. But I also wanted, you said this happened in March, and you also talked about the prior agreements. Talk a little bit of the history there with Russia and Syria. Why did they allow them to be in Idlib and Afrin in the first place when they had essentially kicked them out of everywhere, minus the annexed territory in Rojava by the Kurds, all the rest of Syria? Al-Qaeda had been pushed up into Idlib. Why not finish them off?
Well, when you say they kicked them out of everywhere, they kicked them out because of Russian, negotiations. Russia made it a point to secure as much of Syria as possible for the Syrian government with as little violence as possible. They carried out campaigns designed to box in these separate Syrian Islamist groups. You want to call them rebel groups? They're not other than a handful of units in the north, these other units are basically foreign-funded Islamist elements, heavily comprised
You could call them a Salafist principality, which Hillary Clinton did say, and the DIA report spelled that out, that they're going to sponsor these Salafists, and a lot of them are mercenaries from wherever, Kosovo, Chechnya, what have you. I'm only asking this not in sincerity. I know the answer, but I just wanted to inform everybody. Not everybody's been following this since 2011 or 2013 as to how Russia, through negotiation, mitigated a lot of the violence that could have gone on for years and years by giving them a space in a rather heavily Sunni controlled area from the first place in Idlib. But please continue.
Well, I mean, you answered the question. The bottom line is when Russia came in 2015, it was to stabilize the situation for Assad. Russia was not there to be a guarantor of victory. Russia was there to be a guarantor of stability. And the Russians have always, played that card. There are people who are frustrated with the Russian actions saying, why didn't Russia finish the job? Why didn't Russia do this? Why didn't Russia do that? Wasn't Russia's job. Russia's job was to bring about stability. And they did that by creating the conditions, especially in contested regions around Damascus and in the south, where the rebels were literally faced with, the Salafists were faced with, accept a deal where they could leave with their families or die. And they, without exception, opted to leave. And where they left to was the safe haven of Idlib. And this was deliberately created as a safe haven. Established as a safe haven. Turkey had pretty much secured this in the early years of this fighting by supporting the, various entities, the Free Syrian Army, the Muslim Brotherhood-affiliated Salafists, et cetera. And the decision was to concentrate these elements in Idlib and then focus on a diplomatic solution to this problem. Unfortunately, no diplomatic solution has been found. It's more complicated than just saying, Turkey's bad, Russia's good. There's the question of Iran and, the balance that needs to be struck there, the destabilizing impact a major large-scale Iranian presence has in Syria. There's the question of Hezbollah and the role that Hezbollah plays, which is a tangent to the question of Iran. Russia's been, the broker trying to, make arrangements of reconciliation between Turkey, which has vested interests, Iran, which has vested interests, and Syria, which has sovereign interests. The end result was an agreement that, at least carved out temporarily a sense of stability. What we see here is that Turkey, for a variety of reasons, had opted not to continue this because Turkey has a problem. Turkey has a 5 million Syrian refugee problem. Many of them come from Idlib province and are afraid to go back as long as there's this, this conflict hanging over their heads. And so I think Syria was seeking to create a reality of an independent Idlib that could operate outside of Syrian sovereign control. And which could then be welcoming to the 5 million refugees that are currently in Turkey, that's creating such a political nightmare for Erdogan. But in doing this, he has betrayed everybody. He's betrayed the Iranians. He's betrayed the Russians. He's betrayed the Syrians. And because he's failing, and this is a failed effort, it will not succeed. Erdogan has just dug himself into a very deep hole, and I know he'll eventually get out of it because there are political compromises to be made, but his reputation is shot.
He's shown his true colors. And I'll say this for people following this and maybe not familiar, where is Afrin, where is Idlib? I'll give you a little geography. So we're talking about pretty much the very northwestern portion of Syria, shares a border with Turkey. So it's the Afrin region. East of that is Manbij. East of that is Aleppo. Used to be the second biggest city. I think it still is. And this is the area where they were pushed out of Hama and Homs and Palmyra and Deir ez-Zor and Damascus and Daraa and all the other areas that these head shoppers had temporarily held, into this corner that Turkey had taken in the beginning of the war. Scott, I'd like you to explain also how the Israeli interest in Syria is actually asymmetric warfare against Iran and Hezbollah.
Well, one of the big problems that Israel faces is the fact that it's surrounded by potential and real enemies. In the north, you have Hezbollah in Lebanon. You have Syria, which is a government that has territorial ambitions over the Golan Heights. It is rightfully sovereign territory of Syria. And because of the Hezbollah situation and because of Syria's historic ties to Iran, you have Iran using Syria as a conduit to resupply Hezbollah. And because of Israel's increased military intervention in Syria, hitting airfields and depots, et cetera, associated with this effort to rearm or to arm Hezbollah. Iran has come in and helped Syria build its military. Iran also played a very important role in beating back the Salafists. The Russian intervention in 2015 would not have occurred if it weren't for Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Iranian Quds Force, actually flying to Moscow and making the case. And, when Iran played an important role, they sending thousands of troops and tens of thousands of proxies from Afghanistan and Iraq to fight, on the side of the Syrian army and help bring about, for instance, the liberation of Aleppo, which had been occupied by rebel forces. And to, otherwise, bring about the stability. So, Iran has been a major player in this. Its role became even more so because of Hezbollah, the linkage now, the efforts to resupply Hezbollah and bolster Syrian defense became part and parcel of the same policy. There were no longer two separate policies as a singular policy direction. It even became more so after the events of October 7th. And so from the Israeli perspective, Syria is very much on the front lines of its conflict against Iran. And it views the strategic defeat of Syria as essential to its defeat of Iran. It doesn't separate the two in its mindset. So this is why you saw the pager attack as part of this. I mean, while Israel hasn't acknowledged it, there's no doubt that Israel was involved in this. And the fact that Israel coordinated the activization of these pagers in concert with the Islamist assault on Aleppo shows that there is, strategic cooperation there. That Israel is very much a part of this plan. And now you see the Syrian or the Israeli government. Now that these Turkish-backed Salafists are faltering in their drive towards Hama and other places, saying, well, maybe we have to intervene in southern Syria to divert Syrian forces away from this front. So Israel is very much a part of this planning.
Yeah, Israel, I remember when there was a horrific earthquake and they were getting aid flown into Aleppo. So Israel thought it'd be a great time to attack the airport in Aleppo to try to divert aid away from people who are desperate, in the winter in tents from an awful earthquake that hit both that sort of northwest section of, well, it's also where al-Nusra is now called HTS, Haret Tahrir al-Sham, and Harat al-Sham, too. And all these different conduits that, you know, they just change hats from the FSA back to HCS, back to Adal Sham, back to the, and they, we, it was very open, not just in weapons found smuggled by Purple Shovel from Bulgaria or flown in from Azerbaijan on Silk Airway on diplomatic flights that aren't seen, but from the own U.S. cables and policy papers where people like Jake Sullivan are saying Al-Qaeda is on our side. We are going to foster the Salafist principality. That was open season there. We all know the U.S. is going to support Israel. When Israel says jump, the U.S. says off of what? Not how high, off of which building, sir. I mean, that's the control A pack there. But then in addition to all these different factions and head choppers and Al-Qaeda in Iraq moving to Syria, enemy on that side of the border, friend on the other side of the border, you have a Kurdish faction with the YPG in northern Syria, we call Rojava, which the Turks are not happy about that at all either. They have their own problems with PKK in Turkey. They are sitting on the oil and the U.S. protects them. I did see that in these battles that they were fired upon by these Al-Qaeda groups as well. What could be the possible solution here with all this annexed territory, Afrin by Al-Qaeda, Rojava by the Kurds, and the Americans sitting there? Trump voiced that he was going to remove those 900 troops, tried to do it when he was president, and they just lied to him and didn't do it. Said he's going to do it again. Do you think this recent action will prevent him from being able to remove troops or encourage him to get out of there faster?
I think the key here is the scope and scale of the defeat of the Turkish-backed Al-Qaeda elements in Idlib. If Syria, right now you have Russia, trying to revive the Astana agreements, talking to Turkey, talking to Iran, and talking to Syria indirectly. If this is the path that Russia takes, then the region will be forever sealed in this kind of chaos with ill-defined lines, et cetera. And that chaos is conducive to the continued presence of American troops in the region. We can only exist in a sea of chaos. If, however, and this appears to be the military angle, Russia, Iran, Syria are looking for a decisive defeat of to resolve the Idlib problem. And in doing so, confront Turkey with a major geopolitical defeat, one which could prompt, for instance, the Turkish retreat from the occupied portions of Syria in exchange for instance, Syria, the Russians providing guarantees for the return of the refugees in that are in Turkey, and Russia brokering a autonomy deal with the Syrian government so that Rojava is not Rojava but Syria. If this happens, then I think the United States has no place. We can't remain in Syria, and we will withdraw. So it comes down to what the strategic intent of Russia is, and we have to keep in mind that Russia is very much engaged in Ukraine. And while Russia obviously can walk and chew gum at the same time, the resources that would be needed to guarantee a positive outcome are not going to be available to Russia. Russia will be able to provide air power and some command and control and maybe some limited ground troops. But, the bulk of the fighting is going to have to be done by a remobilized Syrian Arab army and, Iranian forces, including these Iraqi, popular militia units that are making their way into Syria. But this is a fight that I think needs to be done to the death. And Idlib is this this Islamist state that was created is not a viable state. It's a poison. It's a cancer on the region, and it needs to be excised and eliminated. And this is the opportunity to do it. I, you know, normally am a promoter of peace, but right now, to be honest, the solution here is to terminate Idlib as an Islamist entity, and because many of the elements that are in Idlib are not acceptable, for instance, for resettlement anywhere in the world. They can't go back to where they came from, China, Central Asia, and Turkey isn't going to take them in, and they're not going to be resettled in Syria, and they're not going to be allowed to remain in Idlib. I think they've chosen their place to fight and die. And now it's up
to Russia. John Bolton needs some new roommates. I can think of nothing better than taking some of these Salafists and saying, yeah, we'll relocate them. John Bolton, you get one. Sebastian Gorka, you get one. Pair them up with all the neocons that spent billions of dollars creating this mess.
Well, I mean, that would be great in a dream world. I don't know if reality we will be able, unless we imprison John Bolton, and then we can make them cellmates. But
I'm all for that. You mentioned Soleimani earlier, and that was just reminding me, like, if John Bolton hates you the most, you're doing something right.
Well, I have stopped really giving a damn about anything John Bolton says or thinks. He's he had his last moment of relevance as the failed national security advisor of Donald Trump. Nobody listens to this man anymore. The Democrat, when the Democrats invite you in to be their voice of reason, you know how low the Democratic Party has sunk and how irrelevant John Bolton is to mainstream MAGA. Because I don't like to use the word Republican anymore, because the Republican Party, the one that I joined back in the 1980s, no longer exists as a viable entity. It's been replaced by this new entity we call MAGA. And, MAGA has its own, way of thinking, and it's not a Republican way of thinking. And so John Bolton, he's totally irrelevant in the MAGA world. So this is a man, I don't even know why we talk about him anymore. He's put on, the CNN continues to view him as some sort of relevant voice. But in the people that are currently holding the levers of power, he's a non-entity.
Well, I just don't like these guys to slink away without any punishment or retribution for the hell that they've caused other people in other countries. But
well, I think they're dying right now, and I think that is going to be ultimately the solution, because there is no place for them to hide. There's no place for them to run, and I don't think anybody's in the mood to take them prisoner. So I unfortunately think there's going to be a whole bunch of deaths before this thing is resolved, and that isn't necessarily a bad thing.
No quarter for ISIS. Earlier in the beginning of Trump's cabinet picks, we did a show, and now he's picked a lot more, and it's become pretty clear it's pretty much a Zionist sweep. Do you think with this new cabinet coming in with Trump, there'll be any resolution towards the Israelis? Maybe use the get rid of the hostage, free the hostages and have a ceasefire. I don't know if you could really hold the Israelis to that, though. Once they get their hostages back, why wouldn't they just continue to attack Gaza anyway?
At this juncture, I think the hostages are no longer relevant. I say that with a heavy heart, because, of course, I'd like to have them return to their families. No matter how much I despise Zionism and am opposed to Israeli policies, there's a difference between hostages and prisoners of war, and the reason why we use the term hostages and not prisoner of war, even though many of these people are soldiers, they're literally being held hostage. They're not prisoners of war. They're hostages. But
there's hostages on the other side too, Palestinians that were arrested without trial.
Right, but that's not part of the discussion we're having. The discussion we're having, and the only one that anybody's having, unfortunately, is about the return of the Israeli hostages. Hamas has lost all leverage over returning the others. That's just a statement of fact. And I don't think they're going to be returned as part of any settlement. We're at a different stage of the game. Hamas has punched itself out. They will survive. They will continue, but they're not capable of achieving, a strategic victory against Israel on their own. What Hamas now has to do, and what is happening, is Israel, I believe, has fatally wounded itself. And now we're just in a position of waiting for Israel to die. And the Trump administration, even though they've staffed themselves, it's the same thing. If I have terminal cancer and there ain't no helping me, I don't care if you bring in all the great oncologists in the world. You can have the best oncologist. You're not going to save me. I'm going to die. I'm terminal. Israel is terminal right now. They are terminally injured, and much of it is self-inflicted. And Israel, I don't believe, will recover from this. And over time, Israel will cease to exist as a modern, viable nation state, largely because of internal domestic rot and a rotting economy, a rotting society, rotting politics, a military that is just lost. When Moshe Yaalon, who I personally know and worked with, comes out and says that the Israeli army is no longer a moral army, you've got a problem. If you're the Israeli army, and the Israeli army has a problem. So Israel is mortally wounded, self-inflicted, and it's in hospice. Trump can make, with all of his pro-Israeli people, can make their demise, pleasant, or they can go out kicking and screaming. But either way, they're going out, and there's nothing this pro-Zionist government that Trump's putting together can do to stop that. And this is sad for the Palestinian people, because Trump's not going to do a damn thing for them either. But they made, Sinwar made a choice for them, a choice that said, we are going down this path, the end game of which is the creation of a Palestinian state, an independent Palestinian state. And they are now well on the way to achieving this. There's a lot left to be done, but remember, on October 6th, there was no chance whatsoever, not a snowball's chance in hell, that there would be an independent Palestinian state. Today, it's the talk of the town. Whether that can be sustained is another question, but they're on that path. And I think that there's a good chance they will succeed, because Israel will die, but it's not going to be an easy path for the Palestinian people. Israel is a maniacal, genocidal, apartheid state, and they will continue these policies up until the bitter end.
Unfortunately, and you're right. Before, around 2022 or so, I remember Norman Finkelstein even saying he'd kind of given up on Palestine. We'd all done everything you can do, and it was hopeless. But a few things changed. One, Elon bought X, and you and I were both banned on X. Now we're both on there having a conversation. So it freed up a little bit of the media. But then just, it was Israel's overreaction to October 7th, first with the Hannibal Doctrine, and then just setting fire to hospitals and shooting kids in the skull and raping prisoners. And we don't need to go over it all, blowing people's legs off, desecrating graves. This every war crime you could think of, and some they invented. They just recently swapped out sugar with sand for the food aid. Of course, they've blown up the aid trucks. They've shot the aid workers. They've killed journalists. When they waited till the aid truck got parked and then gunned down people who ran to get the food, they tell people to go to a safe area, and then they bomb the safe area. It's just nothing but lies. And they even said, oh, I guess they bombed themselves, and everything has a Hamas tunnel under it that they want to destroy, including the zoo, kill the zoo animals, burn down agriculture. They control electricity, they control water, they have a man-made famine. The whole world sees this, especially outside the United States. So I agree with you that they've bitten off more than they can chew, or painted themselves in a corner, and I just don't see how this can be reversible and how anyone can save them. I do think they kind of dodged one with Iran. They had their last little offensive that didn't seem to penetrate the air defense, so they called off the next wave. But remember, they started that and they ended that. They were the first to hit Iran. We're hitting Iranians in Damascus. They hit Iran again. They did assassinations. So Iran owes them one. Now, I've heard you say before, maybe Iran will sit on that and make them wait. They're trying to move into BRICS and fix their economy, and they really don't need a war with Israel. But that's kind of in doing so. And also, as you just mentioned today, seeing what will happen in the new Trump administration, and you have Hezbollah caught up in the ceasefire they just signed. Syria is sort of isolated right now. It was a perfect opportunity for Turkey to send in the head choppers again. But Trump, you know, he announced to the world, I got rid of ISIS. We did it quickly in weeks and blah, blah, blah. Well, they're back. You didn't get rid of ISIS. Russian negotiations that didn't get rid of them, but got rid of the violence they were doing. And now it's all back again. Except now, unlike in the beginning when they helped Syria, Russia's handcuffed to Ukraine. So that war isn't going well for Ukraine, but I think it's still not over anytime soon. Trump has announced, hey, I'll get that done in 24 hours. I know that's New Yorker hyperbole. He just means quickly in Trumpanese or whatever. How do you see that going once he's inaugurated? What steps could Trump even do to resolve this conflict in Ukraine if Zelensky doesn't want to play ball?
Well, first of all, let me just touch on Iran for a second. Iran doesn't owe Israel anything. Israel's dead. I just want to bring this point up again. And Iran knows Israel's dead. Iran also knows that if they attack Israel, they will lengthen the process of Israel's death by shifting the focus away from, you know, Israel's what killed Israel was a decision by Sinwar. And I wish he was alive. I wish I could interview him to confirm this. But based upon what he talked and what he did, Sinwar realized that the only way you were going to have a Palestinian state was to compel Israel to be Israel at its worst, in a major way, not in a short-term war, not in this, not in that. You know, Israel always exposed its true face, but in limited fashion. Sinwar created the condition in which Israel exposed every facet of how evil this regime is in a sustained fashion that has sickened the world, sickened the entire world, and in the process has fatally injured Israel. So why would Iran?
Even North Korea called them savages. And I guess this is Sun Tzu. When your enemy's making a mistake, don't get in their way.
Well, you know, you say even North Korea. I don't view North Korea as a nation of savages. I do view Zionist Israel as a nation of savages. But Iran has no obligation to commit economic suicide on behalf of Palestine. Palestine will exist. There will be a Palestinian state. They are further on the road to accomplishing that than any time in the history of post-World War II, of the creation of Israel. So why in God's name would Iran throw this all away by creating a war that will transform all discussions away from Gaza and the Palestinian issue to global energy security? Because that's what an Iranian-Israeli conflict will become. It will become a conflict of global energy security, and that'll be the end of Palestine, because Palestine now will become just a chip in a larger game to be negotiated away. Right now, Palestine is the game, and Iran has made a brilliant move in keeping Palestine the game. The same thing with Hezbollah. People are criticizing Hezbollah for what they've done. Hezbollah is thinking strategically. They're keeping the game Gaza. Now, because the West doesn't want the game to be Gaza, they've done this invasion of Syria to, you know, broaden the scope of the conflict. And I think you're going to see that the way that Russia and everybody else responds keeps, in the long term, you know, Palestine very much on the front burner. So I applaud the Iranians for what they've done. It shows great maturity, great vision, great strategic thinking. And I know there's a lot of people that are very frustrated and think that maybe a decisive Iranian strike would somehow, you know, alter the outcome. I'm telling you, it would not, because it will no longer be about Gaza. It will be about oil. It'll be about the price of oil. It'll be about the economy, stupid. And here's the harsh reality. I know we have a lot of Americans demonstrating on behalf of Palestine right now. America doesn't give a damn about Palestine. It's become the topic of the day. We have demonstrators out there, but from a governmental perspective, we could care less. Right now, we have to consider it because it has become a geopolitical issue. But you replace Gaza with energy security, and Gaza will be dropped. Palestine will be dropped, and all we're going to focus on is getting that damn price of oil down, because that's the only thing that matters in the United States. We've never cared about the Palestinian people, and we never will care about the Palestinian people. We care about stability. And, you know, that's why Israel is giving us a gift by killing itself, because we couldn't kill Israel. We put Israel on permanent life support. But Israel's been so bad in the way that they've behaved since October 7, 2023, that they've fatally injured themselves. And I think the smart move for everybody involved is to let Israel die. And you do let Israel die just by letting Israel die. You don't have to do anything. Let the, you know, the Ansarallah is doing a brilliant job of strangling Israel's economy. The threat of Hezbollah will prevent any serious investments. And who wants to invest in a state where its leaders have been indicted by the International Criminal Court and the nation has been indicted by the International Court of Justice as an illegal apartheid genocidal state? So Israel has destroyed itself. As for Ukraine, look, we're in the end game here. Now, people are going to go, well, when? Today? Tomorrow? Russia's never put a calendar date on accomplishing objectives. It simply said, we're going to accomplish these objectives. And that's what Russia's doing right now. They are in the position of strategically defeating Ukraine, militarily, economically, and politically. Look at how this works. Militarily, even the Ukrainians say, it's over. We got nothing. We got nothing left. They're grinding us down, and soon, there just won't be any ability to defend. Economically, it's a basket case. Their energy infrastructure has been ground down to as close to zero as you can get without hitting nuclear power plants, and Russia's not going to do that. The politically, Zelensky's got the lowest approval rating. Fully 60% of the Ukrainian population say we don't want him to run again if there are elections. It's over. Now it's just a matter of waiting it out. The West, here's the problem, that the West has made Ukraine an existential issue for the long-term survival of NATO. And of American strategic objectives linked to NATO, such as the strategic defeat of Russia. And unless there can be a significant policy shift, the Biden administration, and thank God Kamala Harris didn't get reelected, because as I said, we would have had a nuclear war with Russia within 6 months to a year after her swearing in, guaranteed. What we're seeing right now is what Biden's doing in terms of escalation is just a compression of the policies that would have been enacted under Kamala Harris. And we are today closer to a nuclear war than at any time ever. This is a far more dangerous situation than the Cuban Missile Crisis for any number of reasons, foremost of which is we're just not talking to the Russians. The Cuban Missile Crisis was resolved by diplomacy. Diplomacy carried out on multiple fronts, directly between Kennedy and Khrushchev, indirectly through a back channel, directly through various ambassadors at the United Nations, in Washington, D.C., in Moscow. There is none of this connectivity taking place today. And as a result, both sides are driving blind, trying to guess what the other side is going to do. We have the Russians implementing a nuclear doctrine that has lowered the threshold so much that Peskov, Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesperson, has said, you have already crossed it. That if we were purely doctrinally, acting doctrinally, we'd already have permission to use nuclear weapons against you. You have violated one of our major red lines. Please don't. And this is the use of ATACMS missiles on Russian soil in the United States.
Can we explain to people how they rely on foreign satellite detail in order to use the ATACMS? So it's not just Ukraine doing it. They have to work in tandem.
Sure. The ATACMS missile has a it has two kinds of guidance. It has a terrain mapping aspect that provides terminal guidance. And then it has GPS. The GPS is not commercial grade GPS. It's military grade GPS, which means it has to communicate with two military channels, which are encrypted. And this whole concept of encryption is a key aspect of it, because in order to transmit the data needed to, you know, connect with the GPS satellites or to interface with planning elements in Europe that are using American radar and other satellite technology to create target packages that are loaded into the guidance system of the ATACMS missiles, you have to use NSA-protected cryptography, and only the United States has the keys. We don't transfer these keys to anybody. We're not going to transfer them to Ukraine, which means that American hands have to be involved in the communication aspect of it, but we're also the ones who build the target packages, which means we are cognizant of where this missile is headed. We've approved that, and now we're making that possible, and only it can only happen because of what we've done. So from a, in terms of creating the target data and downloading into the ATACMS. So from a Russian perspective, this is 100% an American attack against Russia. This is the United States providing Ukraine with weapons that are directed by the United States. Every aspect of the launch, minus pushing the button, is done by the United States against targets approved by the United States. So this is an American attack against Russia, and the Russians have said that this constitutes an existential threat to Russia's national security and warrants a nuclear response if Russia made that decision. So you know, there's the ATACMS component.
And that fits with their lower threshold. So I was just saying legally how they got to do that. I don't think everybody knows how those are operated. Now there's this.
Yeah, we have a U.S. intelligence community now that says, don't worry about the lowered threshold. Russia's bluffing. Russia's 100% bluffing. They're not going to use nuclear weapons. But this is a U.S. intelligence community that, that sold Obama on Russian collusion in 2016 by manufacturing sources, by exaggerating, cherry-picking sources. There was no Russian collusion in 2016. That is now 100% proven. But this is the U.S. intelligence community that is so overly politicized that their job is not to tell the truth about Russia, but rather to shape the intelligence policy objectives of the chief executive. You can't trust the U.S. intelligence community today when it comes to Russia. They no longer have Russian area experts. They have ideologues, people who are picked not by their knowledge of Russian culture, history, and language, but rather people who wrote theses that said Vladimir Putin is the most evil man on the planet. Therefore, they now are anointed and brought into the community. They're incapable of dealing with the reality of Russia. And so they just fabricate stuff. So the U.S. intelligence community, we can't put, there's a great likelihood that they're wrong on this, that Russia's not bluffing. And therefore, when we continue the policy of enabling Ukraine to use ATACMS missiles, we're just pushing Russia closer and closer and closer to that final threshold where they will use nuclear weapons.
Well, anytime somebody says 100%, you got to be skeptical of that. And to add to what you were saying, these are the same people. You had 51 intel officers that said Hunter Biden's laptop was fake Russian propaganda, and it definitely was not. Remember, Matt Gaetz entered the whole thing back into the congressional record after they lost it over what they said. He goes, okay, and he had an SSD and said, I'm entering this contents of the laptop, which I have, back into the record. It would have been awesome if he was the attorney general. Doesn't look like he would get confirmed because allegedly someone hacked the ethics committee that was looking into sexual misconduct, and they only released the information of the accusations by the women and not the conclusions, which showed they were full of it because the DOJ already did that investigation and did not issue any charges against Gaetz or another man, Christopher Dorfler, who was also involved. I don't mention him anymore, but anyway. They constantly lie. They lied to Obama. They lied to Trump too. they're lying to Biden, although I don't know if he's even there. But you are right, too, about Harris. If she had been elected, and I know, and we're both going to criticize Trump and his cabinet, but it was so much worse with Anthony Blinken and the goobers we have now. There's a high chance we would have been in a nuclear war. So we dodged a bullet Trump style there, since he literally dodged a bullet. Well, I guess it hit him in the ear, but we're rolling into that. Now, there was a new weapon, a kind of mobile hypersonic mid-range MIRV glide cluster bomb. I don't know what you call that. I know you know about missiles. I read your book. Before you talk about this new weapon, though, can you explain to people the special danger about mid-range missiles versus long-range missiles, why they're harder to detect to launch and so on? Because Trump scrapped that treaty, maybe, in his overcorrection to prove how, oh, I'm not pro-Russia. Look, I'll get rid of this.
Well, I'm not going to defend Trump, but I will note that the drive to scrap the treaty began with the Obama administration, which initiated the fabrication of intelligence. Again, I'm pointing to the CIA, the misinterpretation of data deliberately so to create a perception of Russian noncompliance with the INF Treaty when Russia was actually in full compliance with the INF Treaty. Maybe we can get into the details of that intelligence, but it would probably bore the crap out of people. But the point is, the INF Treaty came into being, and it was signed, we're coming up on the 37th anniversary, December 8th, in 1987 by Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. It was put in place to eliminate a category of weapons that were deemed to be fundamentally destabilizing to Europe and the world. In fact, had we not gotten rid of these weapons, there is a distinct probability, likelihood, that there would have been a nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union, the United States and Russia, because these weapons reduce the time frame in which decisions can be made under, you know, under duress, where, you know, you have warnings coming in about missile launches, et cetera. You know, normally with ICBMs, we're talking, 30, 40 minute flight time. By the time you cut through all the crap, the, decision makers will have, 12 to 15 minutes to reflect, to make phone calls, to do things. Right now, under ideal circumstances with INF, you're talking 5 to 6 minutes. And if you've read Annie Jacobson's book, Nuclear War Scenario, they go through a situation where the president is being called upon by his strategic commanders to release the launch codes because you can't launch without the president. And he's still trying to come to grips with what's happening. It's unreal. Is this real? Who can? They're saying, sir, you don't have time. We have to have the launch codes now. And, that's just not an ideal situation. And generally speaking, what happens is the human tendency will be to punt. To give the launch codes, and now we're committed to a nuclear war that can't be stopped. And both the Soviet Union and the United States understood the inherently destabilizing aspect of these weapons. The Pershing II missile, the mainstay of the American Intermediate Nuclear Forces in Europe, launched from a site in West Germany, could strike Moscow in 7 minutes. It just, we were going to have a nuclear war. We got rid of these. I was a weapons inspector involved in the implementation of that. In fact, I was the first weapons inspector on the soil of the Soviet Union when the treaty came into force on July 1st, 1988, because I was already deployed there as part of an advance team. But when we converted from being advance party to inspectors, and the other inspectors who were getting on an airplane in Germany weren't there yet. I was number one. I take pride in that fact, even though it's a meaningless statistic. It's one that I hang on my wall nonetheless. But I played an important role in that treaty, implementing it and making it the success it was. And we got rid of these weapons and we saved the world. I tell people, when you meet a weapons inspector from those early days of the INF treaty, shake their hand and buy them a beer, because without them, you wouldn't be alive. And I'm not exaggerating. There would have been a nuclear war. Proof positive, 1995. The Norwegians launched a weather rocket It got interpreted by Russian radar as a Trident missile launched from a submarine on a low trajectory, which is means the United States is launching a preemptive nuclear strike against Russia. The Russian football was brought to Boris Yeltsin, the alcoholic that he was, and they opened it up, and he was the one being pressured. You have to. Wisely held off.
Oh, the audio went off for a second.
He wisely held off.
Yep. You back? Okay. Oh, there you go.
He wisely held off, and and literally the moment that he said, "I need to make another phone call," the phone call came in and said, "No, it's just a Norwegian test rocket." But had he done what his advisors wanted him to do, he'd have launched, and then we'd be all dead. So this treaty is a big deal, and Donald Trump pulled out of it in 2019 because he's a moron. Because he doesn't surround himself with people who know anything about arms control. They don't know anything about strategic stability. He operates under, you know, misperceptions. And Vladimir Putin reminded him when he launched the Oreshnik. He said, "You made a big mistake pulling out of this treaty because these weapons are back with a vengeance." And that's what the Oreshnik is. It's a intermediate range missile. What separates it from the long range ones is that it's usable. See, a strategic weapon, like an ICBM or something, you can't use it without triggering the kind of panicked response that that I just talked about, that Boris Yeltsin went through. The intermediate missile.
For laymen, let me just dumb it down a little. Siloed missiles can be watched 24/7, and a long-range missile has like a big blast off, and you can see it from above. And so each can watch each other's, and you have mutual assured destruction, so you don't use them. Mobilized weapons that are intermediate that don't give off that signal, it's like too late by the time you notice it. So it's much more dangerous in that regard.
Keep in mind that the Russians, a good part of their land-based missiles are mobile missiles. The SS-27 Yars, or the SS-27 Topol M, and then the Yars, which is a follow-on. Now there's the Yars M. These are mobile missiles that can either be fired from their bases, which can be monitored just like silos, or in an emergency, they get deployed into the giant Russian tundra and disappear into the forests of Siberia. And so they're designed to offset what is perceived to be the American strategic advantage in submarine missiles. The Trident submarines are, at this juncture, undetectable and therefore invulnerable to interdiction. And so the mobile missiles are supposed to give Russia a survivability factor that extends beyond their submarines. So, but the Oreshnik is a road mobile missile, but it is of a range now that if it's launched, because it's not an ICBM, it doesn't trigger the same level of panic amongst Western observers. The Oreshnik has its roots in a system that was created in 1982 by the Russians or by the Soviets called Skorost, quick or speed. And this was a weapon that was designed to respond to the Pershing II. You know, the Pershing II, the Russians understood that the Pershing II could be fatal to Russia. If they were launched, it could do a decapitation strike, et cetera. And so they wanted to create a system that they could flood into Czechoslovakia and East Germany that would be linked to monitoring of the Pershing II bases. And when the Pershing II left its base and went to one of its deployment areas, the Skorost could immediately sally forth and launch a strike designed to kill the Pershing II before it could fire. And that was the purpose of the Skorost missile. And they made it by just putting together bits and pieces of, you know, SS-20 early version, the more advanced Mod 3, SS-25, even the SS-27, which was still very much a research and development missile at that time. They cobbled it all together to come up with this missile. It was ordered to be researched in 1982 and ready for production in 1983. The Russians ultimately didn't go for it because of the INF Treaty, but, you know, that missile was there. Now, with the United States saying they're going to be deploying Dark Eagle, our intermediate range missile, and other capabilities into Europe by 2026, Vladimir Putin ordered the Russians to come up with a response. And it appears that the Oreshnik is this response. It's an intermediate range missile, but its conventional warhead is configured in a way that instead of, you know, what we call MIRS, which is multiple independent retargetable vehicles, reentry vehicles, which will be released from the missile on a bus, and then the bus will maneuver to release the missiles, but the bus is still moving in flight, so the release is on a linear path. The Oreshnik appears to use an advanced warhead delivery system developed for the Yars-M, which uses six independent post-boost vehicles, that is six mini rockets on board, which are six submunitions. These rockets are released, and then they are independently guided to their targets, where they release their submunitions with great accuracy. And the idea here is, as the Dark Eagle is deployed to the field, you will have launchers in different locations, you'll have radars in command, and you know, you'll have to look at how it's configured on the ground, and then this rocket will come in, and these six miniature rockets will come down and each hit put down their submunitions down on the area and take the entire system out. That's what the Oreshnik was designed to do. It was triggered by the deployment or the coming deployment of the Dark Eagle. Now the Russians have this. It's in advanced research and development, and a decision was made to go ahead and make one of the flight tests a combat mission to send a message to Ukraine and the West that there is a price to be paid to strike Russia with ATACMS missiles. And the Russians used this. Right now there's some controversy. The Russians seem to be very satisfied with the results. Ukraine has sequestered off the target, the Yuzmash rocket production facility, and not allowed anybody in there. Satellite imagery that's been released is not of sufficient resolution to make any real assessments. But Western analysts are saying that it's not as destructive as Russia said. So right now there's a perception in the West that this is not the game-changing weapon that Russia wants it to be. Therefore, it can be ignored, and we can continue to launch ATACMS missiles, leading Russia to say, well, we may have to consider using this again, maybe in multiples. And, maybe the target will be more than just a military industrial. It'll be decision-making centers in Kiev. And if you continue, we will expand to hit targets in NATO, more than likely the two anti-ballistic missile sites that the United States has installed in Poland and Romania that can double as a cruise missile launch platform. Now we're talking about Article 5 and in World War III. So it comes, we're at a very dangerous stage in this game that's being played between the United States and Russia. One where, again, the assessments of the U.S. intelligence community seem to be guiding our policymakers. They say Russia's bluffing, Russia's not going to do anything. And, you can't disprove that until the moment Russia isn't bluffing. And by then it's too late.
But also, by the way, everybody listening, give this a share, thumbs up, react. It helps with the algorithm and stuff. Share this on your pages. Scott, you can share it too. It doesn't seem like they had intel on this new weapon either. It just sort of showed up and they were racing to scramble to see what it was and how effective it was and what all it hit in Dnepr City. Hit something.
I think I know the intelligence community and I know how we collect on.
So they did know
everything about this missile. The problem is how we knew it is so sensitive that we can't admit that we knew it. But we identified it properly. We said it was an experimental missile in development and probably a derivative of the RS-26 Rubiège, which it is. Even though Putin says it's a whole new system, the point is they took a Rubiège launcher and a launch canister of the dimensions of the Rubiège, and they stuffed it with a missile that was cobbled together in the same way that I described the Skorost missile being cobbled together in 1982, with existing components of different missiles. Nothing about this system was solely manufactured for the system. This is, they robbed a little bit here, robbed a little bit there, robbed a little bit there, and brought it together to create it. And we've been monitoring it. We knew everything about it, except, you know, maybe, and I have confidence that, you know, this wasn't the first time Russia tested that warhead, that warhead has been tested in various configurations. And the United States was aware of those tests and has monitored those tests. And, you know, we had a fairly decent idea of what this warhead could do, but we can't acknowledge that. We can't come out and say, you know, this is what we know and how we know it. And even when the CIA prepares its assessments for Congress, Congress isn't cleared for half the stuff that goes into knowing what the, you know, what the Russians are doing in ballistic missile development. So I disagree.
Yeah, I don't want to accidentally go into sources and methods or anything. Let's just act like so they knew. So they would also know whether or not this, how close they are to mass producing this, or how many they've already made, or if it's still, how long it'll be experimental.
One thing I would say is that, you know, there might be aspects of this that we, you know, we don't have a full picture on, but if I build a car, you know, there's a difference between me building a one of model where everything's handmade and say, okay, here's the car. Now we're going to move into mass production. Or I go and I pull production pieces off of a Saab, off of a Porsche, off of a BMW, off of a Ford, and I bring them all together and I say, here's my car. And you go, good. And I go, okay, I'm ready to go into mass production. It's going to be a lot easier because these parts already exist. I think the Russians have most of these components in quantities sufficient to, if you go back in their record of research and development that they've admitted to. I don't have to give away any sources and methods here. You know, when you look at the history of different systems, you know, for instance, they typically plan for 10 to 15 flight launches. So they will produce, you know, 10 to 15 systems that are for flight. So there's components out there for, I believe, a number of rockets. So they just have to be assembled. And, you know, and they'll be able to assemble these and create a firing, you know, arsenal while they wait for the weapon to go into serial production.
It's mainly a counter for the Dark Eagle, but they could use this on anything. I mean, it's a ballistic missile.
Yeah, I brought up the Skorost. At the same time that the Skorost was being developed, the Soviets were looking at a system they called the Chukotka, which was basically the Mod 3 version of the SS-20 Pioneer, more accuracy, a little bit more range, but still an intermediate range missile that they were going to deploy in Chukotka, which is Far East Siberia, to threaten the United States make the United States now worried about, you know, an intermediate range system. Right now in Fort Greely, Alaska, we have 44, I believe, interceptors, anti-ballistic missile interceptors. And this weapon, this Oreshnik, is perfectly designed to destroy those silos. This superheated submunition vaporizes reinforced concrete on contact. And you put that down on the matrix of these ground-based launchers, and you can destroy them. If I were the Russians, I would take a regiment and 9 launchers and put it out in Chukotka and put Fort Greely and our early warning radars and everything under immediate risk. 5 minutes, you know, 5 to 10 minutes after launch, do svidaniya, mama. I'm not advising the Russians. I'm just saying I know how they think, and I'm confident that has been brought up, because if they're bringing up the Oreshnik, which is the modern day equivalent of the Skorost, that means that they're reconsidering all sorts of ballistic missile postures. They were once part and parcel of the Strategic Rocket Forces repertoire.
It's interesting what you said about the heat that can go through reinforced concrete. Now, I'm just amateur, but I talk to a lot of people like you, and there does seem to have been a secondary explosion on the target that hit in Ukraine about 40 seconds after the missile hit. So maybe it had burned down and hit, I don't know, ammo or whatever, but there's something that lit up about 40 seconds later. So this can get things underground.
Well, that's the theory. I mean, then you have Theodore Postol, who I respect greatly, running through the physics of this weapon based upon, again, incomplete data. We don't know everything about this, but you know, the point is, you know, for instance, China did a test of a rod from God style weapon, a tungsten rod fired from space coming down at the same, impact velocities with the same temperatures. And what they found is that it produced actually a very small crater. While the heat is tremendous at impact, it converts into plasma, and then the heat is rapidly dissipated, and the penetration isn't as great as one would think necessary, for instance, to, you know, melt through, you know, a massive amount of reinforced concrete and reach an underground, ammunition or explosive storage to get that secondary explosion. Now, they admit that, part of their calculations were derived from, the fact that a tungsten core, because that's what we're talking about, would have ablated or melted down before it hit, so it reduced. But they also said that the greatest kinetic potential isn't achieved at Mach 10 or 11, which is what, the Russians are saying the impact velocity was, but rather, around Mach 3 to 5, at a slower rate, you actually get a better kinetic value in terms of the impact. So there's confusion. We don't know. I believe that the Russians coated this tungsten core with a new carbide alloy that's derived from technologies they use on their reentry vehicles, in which they perfected for their avant-garde glide vehicle. And this allows for the integrity of the tungsten core to be retained while absorbing this temperature, and it may provide a better outcome on the ground. Theodore Postol just but I think that there's things going on with this Russian weapon that we don't understand.
Your audio went out a little bit when you were talking about Ted Postol. For those who don't know, Ted Postol, MIT, actual rocket scientist, he's another person I've interviewed about these. And I interviewed him about the Iron Dome a long time ago. He got everything right there about how it would not be able to stop this and that. Andrei Martynyanov is another person. They kind of disagree on this one, but I'm talking to both and talking to Scott today. You were saying that you think the tungsten was coated with some kind of carbine or alloy or something, and then your audio went out a little bit. So could you just repeat that last part?
Well, I'm just saying that in order to retain the integrity of a tungsten core, you'd have to coat it with some sort of carbide alloy. The Russians are very innovative in this. They've developed specific alloys that are used in their space reentry programs with the avant-garde hypersonic glide vehicle, and I believe they probably coded this system. Ted Postol doesn't believe that changes the physics of the kinetic properties. So what I'm saying is that maybe there's something we don't understand about this weapon. I mean, again, I'm not a physicist. I was a Marine, for God's sakes, and so It's hard for me to, get into advanced, concepts of, how you change physical properties so that the weapon could be more damaging. Once somebody explains it to me, then I can, I'm in a better position to assess it, but I'm not that innovative to be able to come up with it on my own.
It depends on what the coding was. If this is coming in at Mach 10, and as you said, the slower speed actually gets you a better return. Okay, but if you change the internal properties of the tungsten by combining it with whatever, and we don't know what that is, it would have to have an effect. But I'd have to see what Postol's, why he's saying that.
Well, I can send you his I can send you his thing. The paper that he's done up, I'll send it to you so you can read it. again, I have nothing but the high. I first ran into Ted Postal, not physically, but intellectually, when he wrote a paper in 1991 about the Patriot missile and the Scuds. I had played an integral role part in the counter-Scud campaign and was intimately familiar with our inability to interdict Scuds on the ground and in the air. And but I couldn't really talk about it at that time because it was right after the war and, you know, everything's classified. And here comes Theodore Postal, and he writes this paper, and it's just dead on accurate. I mean, I was so impressed with his work. And then I've worked with him. I was familiar that he did in 2000, after 2013, the attack on the suburb of Damascus, you know, the chemical weapons attack that people tried to pin on a Syrian government, and he showed no, it was most probably launched by rebels. And then I've worked with him on the Khan Shaykhun analysis.
Oh, more simple than deconstructing the chemicals and all in that attack and the angle and whatnot is the fact that I'm not going to call them rebels, the Syrian terrorists were videoing themselves with their new weapon, murdering rabbits. I put that video up. Of course, my channel got deleted, but showing what they had and what they're going to do. It's got Turkish labels on the background. I ran that bell, Sibel Edmonds, who she speaks Turkish to, and that's what they were doing. And then suddenly there's an attack and it's on other Alawites. They only killed like 72 people, which wouldn't make any difference in the war. But it's exactly the red line that Obama set that you could not cross. And then like he's suddenly going to go, oh, well, I can't do that. Well, then I'm going to gas people. It didn't make any sense. And then in addition to that, you can look at the trajectories and how it came in and break it down and figure out where it was fired from and that it was from the terrorists. In addition to all I just said,
well, Postal did more of the trajectory kind of work, and it's very convincing. Good math, good theory. So I just have a lot of respect for Theodore Postal. So, you know, and he and I both agree that it's highly unlikely that Vladimir Putin would go out and lie about something of this nature. You know, because Vladimir Putin made a couple presentations. One the same day of the attack, the next one the next day when he was with his generals. And the confidence he exuded in the facts that he quoted, you know, all seemed to point to the Oreshnik being a very successful weapon. And then, you know, one, the success, which is postulated by, you know, those comments, exceeds what one would... exceeds by far the results that Postal comes up with in his analysis. So we're both a little confused about what's going on, but it's hard to get data. This is a top secret Russian program, and the intelligence community isn't going to let us know what they know. And you know, it'd be nice if the Russians released the test data of the Oreshnik missile, and we could say, oh, that's how they did it. But that's not what they're going to do right now. So you know. From the Russian perspective?
Well, it also used to be the case that like satellite data was pretty neutral. They seem to have saturated images. There's something going fishy with that even. Can't even rely on that.
Satellite and imagery,
the propaganda from Ukraine's side. You know, they remember the beginning of the war, the Ghost of Kiev, and then they had like some video game footage that they claimed was real. I mean, it's just been ridiculous. So it's,
well, I'm just also, as somebody who's looked at satellite imagery for a living, I'm just here to tell you right now, just because you have a picture doesn't mean you know what's going on the ground. You could have the most high resolution photograph and you don't know what's going on the ground. It's useful, but it's, I'm always leery of people who go, here, I got a picture. I'm like, and? Because when I was a weapons inspector in Iraq, the CIA would always come in with the high resolution U-2 photographs. And they'd show me a photograph. This is a, you know, this is this site, you know, and here's a, you know, building number 7, and it's suspicious activity. We have a crane doing suspicious activity, and we have this and that and the other thing, and this is suspicious, and this is, and I said, you guys do know that I was just on that site on the ground last week. when this photograph was taken. Oh, we didn't know that. Yeah, it's not suspicious. There was a flood there last month, heavy raining, that, you know, undermined the foundation. The crane's there to, you know, bring in concrete fairings to shore it up. There's this, that, and the other thing. And suddenly all the suspicious activity was no longer suspicious because you could explain it. I'm just here to tell you right now that even if we had high-resolution satellite photographs, I'd want a little bit more before I start making calls because I've just been...
No, it's just one piece of data, obviously. But, like, I wonder how somebody can get expertise in such a thing anyway. This isn't like a radiologist looking at bones or something. How often does a brand-new type of missile hit a thing and you just know from flashes or whatever? You can't, how did you know? Very little, other than, like, oh, it looks like six and big boom here, there. I mean, what else can
right,
you get?
Right, but if you... I'll give you an example. If I... Well, hypothetically speaking, I'm an intelligence analyst who has tracked the development of this system. And I have...
Hypothetically.
Well, I mean, because it is. I didn't track the Oreshnik. But let's say I have a variety of overhead assets, you know, satellite photography, infrared, radar... of the testing, and then I combine that, you know, with I have a visual signal now that I'm familiar with because I've seen it from overhead. And let's say hypothetically, we intercepted the initial reports of the, you know, on the ground reports, the guys reporting back, hey, this is what it did, this is what we found, you know, boom. Now I can link a visual cue to a more detailed readout, and so now I look at overhead photographs of this weapon being used at Uzmash. And I look on the ground and I see a visual cue that matches a result from the test that I now link to, you know, a readout by people on the ground. And I can, with reasonable certainty, say, I believe that in this impact right here, because it matches physically a result where we have a known quantity attached, that the following was achieved. That's how you do it. But you can't sit there and look at that photograph without any other input and go, oh, this didn't accomplish anything or this accomplished everything. You'd have to have other information that is derived from, you know, a firsthand examination of the impact.
Yeah, and of course, both sides have reason to keep it super secret of...
Yeah, there's no reason for the Russians to want to
rush aside, protecting what they did.
They're not going to help you and I come up with it. I'm not going to call up the Kremlin and go, hey, could you guys help me out? I'm doing this Spaces with Ryan Dawson, and we really want to look smart, super smart. So could you, like, give me some top secret stuff so I you know, no. The Russians could care less what you and I think. We're not part of their equation. The Russians do information warfare differently than in the West does. You know, in the West, we're trying to win over public opinion. And the Russians, to be honest, could care less about public opinion, especially in the West. They're not trying to influence us. So they're not going to do anything to, you know, to help you and I get a better insight into the performance of the Oreshnik as much as we want them to.
That's true. A quick question I didn't ask before when we were talking about the Middle East. But do you think Erdogan has joined the quicksand with Bibi?
Well, I don't know if Erdogan's going to get an ICC, you know, indictment or arrest warrant, but I think his reputation is 100% shot. You know, he is, how could you ever trust him again? I mean, my understanding is that the Iranians are furious, the Russians are furious, the Syrians are furious.
Oh, with me, there's no again.
Well, but then there's
no again.
The problem is
he is the
president of Turkey, and, you know, diplomacy requires you to make compromises with people you wouldn't otherwise deal with. So, you know, Putin is going to have to deal with Erdogan. So is, you know, the Iranian president. So is Assad. But I think the days of them looking Erdogan in the eye and feeling the firmness of his handshake and drawing some sort of, you know, consolation from that is over. You know, they're always going to be, you know, guarded in anything he puts on the table. And I think they're going to insist on, you know, greater degrees of verification and you know, higher scope and scale of commitments that you can't, you know, trust Erdogan to do something. You're going to have to spell it out and be able to confirm, you know, to verify that he has indeed done what he said he's going to do.
Well, I mean, they shot down a Russian plane years ago, and he got a nice smack on the hand for that. And there was some attempted coup they blamed on Fethullah Gulen or whatever. But yeah, I don't know how you could trust him. But I was thinking more not just from statehood, but his own public is going to look at him knowing, oh, you didn't lift, you're not one bullet against the Israelis, but you're going to send in Salafists into Syria to fight with Assad. What the hell? I mean, all of them are against Israel. Like, I'm just the regular person on the street. They're seeing what's happening in Gaza. They know all their crimes for many decades, and they wish they would do something about it. He said he was ending trade, oil and gas, concrete, and listed a number of things. And then turns out he didn't do it. At first, it was intermediary, so send it to Greece or Cyprus, and then it goes to Israel or whatever. Now there's evidence of, now they're directly still taking that BTC gas and oil and sending it to Israel. So really didn't do anything. But boy, he's willing to go to war for Israel and America in Syria, fighting against the government there. So that's what I meant, is he's done publicly the way the public in Israel hates BB2, but you are correct. He's probably not going to get ICC labeled as a war criminal or anything unless he really ups it. But I would argue that arming and aiding Al-Qaeda groups should count as that, considering what they do when they can. I had you over an hour. If you got to go, I'll let you go. If you can take that another question, I have about 20. How are you doing on time? We might have lost his mic. Oh, he might have to go and come back again. Let me see. I'll DM him, see what's going on. I don't even know if he heard my question there. The space, this is the nature of Twitter spaces, by the way, just kind of the reason we do these on Rumble. Did it drop? Yeah, I'm just giving it a DM. All right, let's see. Sorry, folks, I'm not technically proficient either. Well, let's see. It looks like Ritter got bounced. That happens in spaces. I'm going to see. All right, well, you guys should all, you should check out all of Scott Ritter's stuff. He's on YouTube, he's on Rumble, he's got Ask the Inspector, he's got his own website, he's got a Substack. I'm going to put all the links in the nest, as they call it, underneath this. And I don't know if we're going to get him back tonight, but he gave us an hour and a half anyway. And it's very interesting about Ukraine. Kind of started off in the Middle East and Syria. And then, yeah, if you ask the weapons inspector about new missiles, you know, what do you think? But he's got his new books out. So Scott Ritter, follow him on Twitter. You can just go to @RealScottRitter, give him a follow, and give him a thank you for doing these. We usually do these on Rumble and push them out. We're trying Twitter spaces to see how it went, because we have about 500,000 followers between us. So I hope you enjoyed that. And we'll be talking with Andre Martinyanov later, and then Matthew Ho. He just got back from Palestine, or, you know, adjacent to it. What a trip he had. He was his captain, too, another veteran. And, yeah, we'll see you over on the Anti-Neocon Report. And I'm going to kick this over to Telegram to talk with them. So if you're following me there, you can go listen there. And sorry that the space dropped Scott Ritter, but we were about to end it anyway. So see you then.